Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I'm a Microsoft worker, and I do not consent.
Thank you. 50,000 Palestinians
in Gaza have been murdered with Microsoft technology.
That's one of two Microsoft software engineers fired this week for protesting Israel's use of Microsoft's AI and cloud technology in its assault on Gaza. We'll go to Seattle to speak with one of the fired workers. But first, a Michigan lawyer, a U.S. citizen, was detained and questioned at the Detroit Metro Airport. He was forced to surrender his cell phone.
This wasn't just a search, it was intimidation. And if they can do this to me, imagine what they can do to people without legal training or a platform. This is about power, surveillance, and erosion of our rights at the border.
Then we go to a new feature film on life in the occupied West Bank. It's called The Teacher.
Welcome to our home.
How do you keep them on track in an environment like this?
Some of them stop seeing the point anymore.
She's come to see you. Maybe you can benefit from it.
You're not confined in that prison anymore. And I'm here for you. You have to finish school. Deku, please, man.
They're setting fire to the olives.
We'll speak to the director, Farah Nabulsi, and the star, Salah Bekri. But first, the Supreme Court unanimously orders the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia to the United States. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. China's announced it's raising tariffs on U.S. products from 84 to 125% as a trade war between the two countries escalates. Beijing's retaliation came after Trump imposed a 125% tariff on China, which he says comes on top of an earlier 20% tariff for a total tariff of 145%. Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke earlier today as he met with Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez in Beijing.
China and Europe should fulfill their international responsibilities, jointly uphold the trend of economic globalization in the international trade environment, and work together to oppose unilateral bullying.
Stocks plunged again Thursday following Wednesday's market rally amidst mounting concerns over Trump's escalations with Beijing. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Senators Adam Schiff and Ruben Gallego have called for a federal investigation into possible insider trading in Trump's White House related to his tariff orders. This is Senator Schiff.
You may have seen early in the day Trump tweet this. Now, this is a good time to buy. So the question is, between that tweet and Donald Trump's announcement that he was reducing the tariffs on most other nations apart from China, the question is, who knew what the president was going to do? And did people around the president trade stock knowing the incredible gyration the market was about to go through?
Among those facing scrutiny is far-right Congressmember, close Trump ally, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who invested some $750,000 in U.S. Treasury bonds in the weeks leading up to Trump's so-called Liberation Day when he announced his global tariffs. The Supreme Court has unanimously ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia to the United States after the Maryland resident was denied due process rights and deported to the Cecat mega prison in El Salvador, infamous for human rights abuses, including slave labor and torture. Abrego Garcia is a husband and father of three. His family fled El Salvador in 2011 when he was 16 after gang members extorted his family and threatened to kill him. The Trump administration's admitted Abrego Garcia was removed because of an administrative error, but argued it could not bring him back because he's now in Salvadoran custody. On Thursday, none of the court's nine justices dissented from an unsigned option, rejecting that argument and affirming U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnes's order that the Trump administration must facilitate and effectuate Abrego Garcia's return. But the court remained vague on how exactly this would happen. He's one of at least 278 men accused of being gang members and deported by the Trump administration to SECA without due process, many of them solely on the basis that they had tattoos. It's believed 90% of them have never been charged with a crime. Tens of thousands of people have signed a petition calling for a boycott of Avalo Airlines after the low-cost carrier signed an agreement to fly deportation flights for the Trump administration. This week, protesters rallied at Tweed New Haven Airport in Connecticut as the state's attorney general, William Tong, sent a letter to the company questioning its contract with ICE. Tong said, quote, Avalo has freely chosen to profit from and facilitate these atrocities. The state of Connecticut has an obligation now to review this business decision, unquote. A federal judge in Louisiana is set to rule today on whether the Trump administration has grounds to deport Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent U.S. resident and Columbia University graduate who helped organize campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Ahead of today's ruling, Secretary of State Marco Rubio filed a brief two-page memo conceding Khalil has no criminal history and that the U.S. is seeking to deport him based purely on his beliefs. In Gaza, Israeli forces killed at least 10 people, including 7 children, today in an attack near the southern city of Khan Yunis. Separately, at least 2 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli strike on Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, where Israeli ground forces were seen blowing up and demolishing Palestinian homes and businesses as Israel expands its so-called buffer zone. Israel's siege of Gaza is now in its 40th day after it shattered the ceasefire March 2nd. Doctors Without Borders has called it a slow death for Palestinians who face severe shortages of food, water, and medicine. Israel's released a Palestinian prisoner who was held for nearly a decade after his arrest at the age of 13. In 2015, Ahmed Manasra was arrested and jailed after an altercation with 2 Israelis near an illegal settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. The settlers survived the attack. Manasra's cousin was shot dead, and Manasra was severely beaten and run over by an Israeli driver. He was convicted of attempted murder, even though he was a child at the time and carried no weapon. Family members hope he can now receive treatment for severe mental health problems he developed during his 9.5 years in prison from the age of 13. There have been more protests against Israel's assault on Gaza and California. 12 people were arrested Wednesday while blocking traffic near the Travis Air Force Base. Flights carrying U.S. weapons have departed from Travis, as have deportation flights. Meanwhile, British police arrested the head of Greenpeace UK after activists from the group died a pond at the U.S. Embassy in London Red to protest the U.S. role in fueling, quote, an indiscriminate war that's seen bombs dropped on schools and hospitals, entire neighborhoods blasted to rubble and tens of thousands of Palestinian lives obliterated, unquote. Sudan presented its genocide case against the United Arab Emirates before the International Court of Justice Thursday.
The direct logistic and other support that the UAE has provided and continue to provide it to the RSF and their affiliated militia has been continue to be the primary driving force behind genocide now taking place, including through killing, rape, forced displacement, looting, and the destruction of public and private properties.
The UAE rejected the charges and called on the International Court of Justice to throw out the case. The World Court can take years to deliver a final ruling on such cases, but can issue emergency measures that are meant to prevent further escalation. The devastating war between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces is nearing its 2-year mark, April 15th. All parties to the conflict have been accused of gross human rights violations and war crimes. A new Amnesty International report details sexual violence used as a weapon of war by RSF fighters against women and girls as young as 15. The UK's defense minister has called on other Ukrainian allies to move ahead with the joint armed presence in Ukraine to ensure any forthcoming peace agreement with Russia is implemented. The meeting of the self-described coalition of the willing comes as Ukraine has accused Russia of stalling on a ceasefire deal and of preparing for a major military push. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is joining his counterparts virtually at the Brussels meeting amidst uncertainty over U.S. support for the coalition's plans. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Russia today for talks with the Kremlin. Meanwhile, talks between U.S. and Ukrainian officials on a minerals for security deal are also expected to start today. Back in the U.S., the Republican-led House passed a bill Thursday to require documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote in federal elections. Under the SAVE Act, voters would have to produce a passport, birth certificate, or naturalization papers, a requirement critics say will disenfranchise millions. The move would effectively end voter registration by mail and online. Anyone who has changed their last name after marriage or for other reasons could be barred from voting if their citizenship documents don't match their current ID. Rural and low-income voters are also less likely to have access to these documents. The bill is not expected to garner the necessary 60 votes to pass in the Senate. President Trump's ordered the Justice Department to investigate two officials from his first term who publicly pushed back against Trump's lies about fraud in the 2020 election. Trump accused one of the officials, former Homeland Security Chief of Staff Miles Taylor, of treason. The other target is former head of U.S. cybersecurity Chris Krebs. Trump also revoked security clearances for Taylor and Krebs. Miles Taylor wrote on social media in response, quote, "Dissent isn't unlawful. It certainly isn't treasonous. America is headed down a dark path," he said. A group of House Democrats are ramping up pressure to force Elon Musk out of the White House by May 30th, which will mark the end of the legally permitted 130-day term of what's called special government employees. This is Texas Congressmember Greg Kassar.
Trump and Musk have exploited Musk's designation as a so-called special government employee to allow Musk to receive over $8 million a day in federal government contracts and subsidies while ignoring our conflict of interest rules and while funneling more and more money to himself and to his companies.
Democrats say Musk should not be allowed to return as a special government employee for at least a year and must first divest from his companies, including Tesla and SpaceX. House Republicans passed a Senate and Trump-approved budget framework Thursday, fast-tracking a plan to cut $4 trillion in taxes for the wealthy and another $1.5 trillion in spending, largely targeting essential services like Medicaid and nutrition assistance. In the Dominican Republic, the death toll from a Santo Domingo nightclub roof collapse Tuesday has topped 220 people. Among the victims of the disaster were the beloved merengue singer Ruby Perez and two former Major League Baseball players, Octavio Dotel and Tony Blanco. And in New Zealand, a hotly contested bill which would have rolled back indigenous Maori rights has been defeated. The measure, which sought to reinterpret the Treaty of Waitangi, was met with widespread protests both on the streets and inside parliament, led by indigenous lawmakers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court's ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the United States after the Maryland resident husband and father of three with no criminal record was denied due process rights and sent to the notorious Secat prison in El Salvador. But the court remained vague on how exactly this would happen, and the Trump administration has claimed it has no way of ensuring his safe return. This comes as a federal immigration judge in Louisiana is set to rule today on whether the Trump administration has grounds to deport Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent resident of the United States and Columbia University graduate student who played a key role in organizing campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Ahead of today's ruling, Secretary of State Marco Rubio filed a short memo that concedes Khalil has no criminal history and argues he should be deported as part of U.S. efforts to combat anti-Semitism. For more, we're joined in New York by Ramzi Kassem, part of Mahmoud Khalil's legal team, professor of law at the City University of New York, or CUNY, where he founded and co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Ramzi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's first look at this unanimous Supreme Court ruling that Kilmer must be returned from El Salvador, or at least the U.S. must facilitate this. What exactly does this mean?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. The decision in Mr. Abrego Garcia's case is, a bittersweet win for him and his family, of course. You know, he's been taken away from them in such an unjust and cruel fashion and taken to one of the most notorious facilities in El Salvador. The decision confirms that the government needs to facilitate, but asks the lower court to clarify what it meant when it said that the U.S. government should effectuate. And that's just a reference to the limits of the U.S. government's power to control the actions of a foreign sovereign here, El Salvador. It may take some time. The bottom line is that it may take some time because, of course, the U.S. government cannot order another government to do anything now that it has put Mr. Abrego Garcia in this position. But it is still a step in the right direction and hopefully will lead to his return home to his family, or at least, unfortunately, to immigration detention in the United States while the government works out its theory for why he should be removed, even though he received legal protection in the past.
And can you talk about your own client? Can you talk about Mahmoud Khalil, a Louisiana judge ruling today exactly on what? Could the judge rule that Mahmoud could be freed?
Well, Amy, the government's strategy in Mr. Khalil's case and actually across the board in these cases where the government has outrageously detained student activists in the United States, including permanent residents like Mr. Khalil, simply for speaking up in defense of Palestinian rights and lives, their strategy in many of these cases has been to speed up and accelerate the removal cases, the administrative immigration cases, because that is the court that they fully control. Every immigration judge serves at the pleasure of the president, and simultaneously to slow down the federal habeas corpus cases that the prisoners themselves, men like Mr. Khalil and Ms. Oesterk, have brought in federal court to challenge the constitutionality of their detention, to tie up those federal cases and jurisdictional issues. So what's happening in Louisiana in immigration court is symptomatic of that strategy. Immigration cases very rarely, in my experience, move this quickly. I've never seen one move this quickly through the system. So that's already not a good sign. That's a sign that there may be some political interference. Now, the immigration judge today is supposed to rule on removability, whether or not Mr. Khalil is deportable. Of course, theoretically, if she finds that he is not deportable under the government's charges, then, she should set him free. But I think we should be focused on the other alternative, which is that the immigration judge will find him removable, that she will agree with potentially the government's argument that Marco Rubio's two-page memo is all that she needs to find him removable, and that she cannot interrogate the Secretary of State's finding in that two-page memo that Mr. Khalil and another individual whose name is redacted, that their very presence or activities or their speech constitutes such a problem for U.S. foreign policy somehow that they have to be deported. Now, that is the government's position, that all it needs is that two-pager to put someone like Mr. Khalil, who's a permanent resident with a U.S. citizen wife who's expecting their first child this month, behind bars and to remove them from the country that they call home. And if the immigration judge agrees with that position, that would be another outrage and a long series of outrages in Mr. Khalil's case as he continues to fight for his freedom in federal court.
I want to thank you for being with us, Ramzi Kassem, part of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil, professor of law at the City University of New York, known as CUNY. He co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic creating law enforcement accountability and responsibility. As we turn to another lawyer right now, on Thursday, ICE deleted a post on X with a graphic that said, quote, "If it crosses the border illegally, it's our job to stop it." and showed the words people, money, products, and ideas. This week, Homeland Security said it's now surveilling the social media posts of international students and immigrants for alleged anti-Semitic activity. Amidst the crackdown on international students who exercised their free speech rights during Palestinian Solidarity campus protests last year, new felony vandalism and conspiracy charges that are some of the harshest yet were filed Thursday against 11 Stanford University students and one former student involved in a building takeover last June. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Customs and Border Protection at the Detroit Metro Airport detained a lawyer, a U.S. citizen, representing a pro-Palestinian protester facing a felony charge stemming from an encampment at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Civil rights attorney Amir Makhled and his family were returning from a spring break trip when he was detained and asked about his clients and asked to hand over his cell phone. He's based in Dearborn, Michigan, and is joining us now. Welcome to Democracy Now, Amir. Explain exactly what happened.
Well, good morning, Amy. Thank you. What happened is I was returning home from spring break with my wife and kids. And as I approached the passport control desk, an agent asked if there was a TTRT agent available. I didn't know what that acronym meant, so I did a Google search, and it meant Tactical Terrorism Response Team. That's when another agent summoned me to and my family members to a secondary screening room. And at that point, I was separated from my family. My wife and children were allowed to continue and leave. But what happened next was quite interesting to me. It didn't seem as if this was a random stop or a routine search. This was targeted. The special agent that approached was wearing plain clothes. He knew who I was. He knew that I was an attorney, and he knew that I had been representing, individuals in high-profile cases as of late, which was a reference to the case of Samantha Lewis. Samantha is one of my clients who has been charged in the encampment at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. At that moment, the agent asked if my cell phone was with me. I said yes, and he handed me a pamphlet. The pamphlet had an explanation of the federal statute that allows for at the border for federal agents to seize my communication device, my telephone. I told them I wasn't ready to give up my phone because my phone contains a lot of confidential information and probably over a decade worth of emails and text messages and files from my work as an attorney. At that point, he brought in a supervisor, and the supervisor indicated to me that if I write down on a legal pad everything that I believe could be privileged, we won't go through that. Otherwise, we're taking your device. Knowing that the government could take my device, I still pushed back and said, no, I'm not going to engage the government in this exercise of writing down what could be confidential and what could be privileged information. That's a futile exercise, an impossibility to do in this setting. Last, they come back to me and say, look, if you show us your contact list, we'll give you your phone back. Otherwise, we're taking it. And so at that point, I acquiesced. I said, okay, I didn't want my device to be taken by the government because in other cases, I've known that the government could take your phone for days, weeks, or even years in some extreme cases. So I didn't want to be in that position where I didn't have my device. And once it was outside of my control and custody, who knows what the government could do with all the information that was contained in regards to my client's information. They came back with a list of questions about individuals on my contact list. That's when I said this has gone too far. I cannot divulge whether individuals on my contact list are going to be clients, friends, or otherwise. So I told them this: whoever's in my phone is going to be a client, a friend, or a family member, and that's all I'm going to engage in. And the reason why I feel that this was a targeted approach is because they knew my history. They knew my travel history. They knew that I had been traveled overseas several times in the past years. They had a whole profile about me. And that showed to me that this wasn't something that was random. This wasn't a routine search. This was targeted. And the fact that they brought up my cases, including the high-profile case that I'm involved in right now, showed and was, to me, an intimidation attempt. It was an attempt to dissuade. And when I look at what the current administration is doing, they're attacking attorneys. They're attacking immigration lawyers in federal court for what they claim to be as frivolous filings for asylum seekers. They're attacking big law firms in Washington, D.C. Through executive orders. And so this is another example of our current administration pushing back and trying to stop the individuals who are speaking up on the war in Gaza. Our client in this situation, Samantha Lewis, has decided to take a position in the University of Michigan encampment case to fight back. That case is involving the criminalization of free speech. None of those students were engaged in anything that was violent. They were peaceful demonstrations with an encampment. And the campus safety police came in with a very strong showing of force, wearing riot gear, holding batons, and engaging in mace and other type of chemical repellents, and started busting up this encampment as they were walking in unison in riot gear. And whatever was in their way, whether it was a tent, a desk, a chair, these officers were using their batons and showing force and destroying anything in their path. And that included protesters. And those who resisted that were charged with felonies.
Now, I mean, is the border some kind of no man's land? You're a U.S. citizen. You're an attorney. Our phones now contain so much information. It's like police coming to your home and demanding to get in, right, for into your office. Do they require
Absolutely.
A warrant? And why didn't they in your case? You are a U.S. citizen and you're a lawyer.
I was born in Detroit, Michigan. They do not require a warrant. They can have a warrantless search without probable cause, without any reasonable suspicion. The statute at the border gives a wide range of authority for government to seize devices. Now, it's supposed to be done in the sense of national security. That's the claim. But at this point, everything has been, as you could see from the current administration, even political dissenters are now looked at as a threat to national security. Somebody who protests the war on Gaza is a threat to national security. So it could be anything. But the question becomes, of these warrantless searches and of all the devices that the government has seized in the years that they've been doing this, what has led to actual convictions? And I don't believe that the government even knows what that figure is. It's an unreasonable search, and it's a trample on our constitutional rights at the border. Our rights shouldn't be stripped at the border crossings. We shouldn't have the ability to have the protections of the Fourth Amendment because we're entering back into the United States at a border crossing. My advice to anybody traveling that's worried about government getting into their data is to take a different device without all of your data on your phone. You'd have to almost travel with a burner phone, and for lack of a better word. This is the only way that you can adequately protect yourself from not having your phone confiscated, because they have the right to do it.
And at this point, do you know exactly what they took from your phone?
No, I would have no idea. I gave them only authority to look at my contact list. In fact, I wrote it down and I said, only my contact list is not going to be what I claim to be privileged. And whether or not they took information outside of that, I would have no idea.
So what do you recommend to people who are not lawyers and are traveling? Most people don't even know what a burner phone is and require what's in their phones to contact people.
So my recommendation is, don't unlock your phones. If you're coming through the border, keep your phone off. And if an agent does request a secondary screening and your phone is subject to a search, you can keep your phone turned off. You don't have to give them your password. You don't have to give them facial recognition. You don't have to comply with opening your phone and showing agents what's in your phone. And if they do decide to confiscate your phone, there are redress programs. There is an ability to get it back. The question is how long. And those are the CBP policy, Customs and Border Protection policy, indicates that the actual confiscation of a phone has to be done in the most extreme cases where there is a high level of national security concern. Now, we don't know exactly what that test is. It's not a bright line rule, and most individuals coming through the United States should not be, especially as citizens, considered as a national security threat. But, you know, at this point, we have no idea.
Amir Maklid, I want to thank you for being with us. Michigan-based civil rights lawyer, U.S. citizen, defending a pro-Palestinian activist at the University of Michigan encampment. He was detained and questioned Sunday at the Detroit Metro Airport when coming in from a family vacation in the Dominican Republic. Asked about his clients, told he had to surrender his cell phone. When we come back, we speak with one of two Microsoft software engineers fired this week for protesting Israel's use of Microsoft AI and cloud technology and its assault on Gaza. And then we'll look at a new film that's premiering tonight. It's called The Teacher. Stay with us.
Tómame tus brazos y embriágame de amor. Y llena mis sentidos de ti. Pon tu boca pequeña dentro de la mía. Y dame un beso sin fin.